There's a culture war going on in this country. We can no longer remain silent on the issues that affect us all. Decisions we make now will determine our future. But how do we engage with the culture in a way that honors Jesus? How do we rise above the noise to know what is right and what is true? It's time to bring God back into the conversation. It's time to reconnect. Here's Carmen.
Welcome, friends. I'm Carmen LaBurge, and this is The Reconnect, where we're putting God in His place, back where He belongs, right in the middle of every conversation. So how do we do that? How do we enter into the conversations of the day as the ambassadors of Jesus Christ? How do we speak the mind of Christ on the matters of the day? I mean, let's face it, people don't need another piece of our mind. What they need is the very piece of the mind of Christ. Now, I think you are just the person to give it to them. We invite you to connect with us online. We're at reconnectwithcarmen.com. You can like us on Facebook. Let us know what you're thinking about. I'm on Twitter at Carmen LaBurge. All right, folks. So today, topping the headlines everywhere is probably the Senate's action on the nomination of Betsy DeVos to serve as the Secretary of Education for the United States. So that has been quite a showdown. I don't know if you've been paying attention to that, but the Democrats stayed up all night. They talked all night. They jammed the phone lines seeking to influence senators to vote against the president's nominee. Apparently, the search on Google that was trending this morning in the lead up to the vote at noon, or that ended at noon, was several different ways of Googling, like, how do I get in touch with my senator? So there you go. People wanted to influence this vote maybe more than others. And in the end, the U.S. Senate approved the nomination of Betsy DeVos to serve as Secretary of Education. It was the narrowest approval of a cabinet nominee in U.S. history. Vice President Mike Pence broke the tie, serving as president of the Senate. So why do the Democrats hate Betsy DeVos so much? Well, I think that ultimately this is not going to be a contest between the Democrats and Betsy DeVos. This ultimately comes down to understanding that this is a real showdown between a guy named John Dewey and pragmatic humanism in terms of an approach to education, and a guy named Abraham Kuyper and his understanding of sphere sovereignty. Now, you're saying to yourself, what in the world is Carmen talking about today? All right, well, folks, I'm trying to bring the Christian worldview to bear on the headlines of the day. The headline of the day is Betsy DeVos is not somebody that teachers like. Teachers unions don't like her. The Democrats don't like her. People who love the Department of Education don't like her. Well, should Christians like her? That's really what this comes down to. So she's going to bring a Christian worldview, in particular, a reformed Christian worldview, to bear on education in the United States of America. That's essentially what this is going to be a showdown about. So you got to go back 100 years. I know you're saying to yourself, okay, I'm going to get a little history lesson. That's right. You got to go back 100 years, and you got to look at what was happening in terms of education on both sides of the Atlantic, because you had an educational reformer in the Netherlands, whose name was Abraham Kuyper. He eventually became the 24th prime minister of the Netherlands, but he was an educational reformer before he was prime minister. And over here on our side of the pond, you had a guy named John Dewey. And you're saying to yourself, Dewey, I know that. That name sounds familiar to me. I went to public school. The Dewey Decimal System. Well, yes, that was part of Dewey's educational reform in the U.S. So when you hear people screaming and pulling out their hair that Betsy DeVos wants to, you know, she wants to undo public education. She wants to, in one part of an article on Mother Jones' website, she wants a radical redirection. No, she doesn't just want a radical redirection. She wants total reformation. Total reformation of education. And from a Christian worldview, is that something that we should be excited about and support, or is that something that we should fear and loathe? That's really what it's going to come down to. I am on the side of supporting it and celebrating it, but you are going to make your own determination. Here's what I want us to understand. I want us to be able to enter into the conversation of the day, actually understanding what the reformed Christian worldview is in relationship to education. And I also want us to unmask some of the falsehood that is out there in relationship to what Betsy DeVos has said and what she, if you understand her background, if you understand the theological framework out of which she is operating, then you will understand what she's talking about in ways that the world would never understand. So the Democrats are, they are total, they don't know this necessarily, but they are total pro-Dewey education people. They are pro the Dewey system. Now, frankly, pretty much any teacher who's been educated in the last 100 years is a pro-Dewey person because they have been educated to be professional social engineers. That's essentially what Dewey wanted teachers to become. Teachers were not people who were themselves the curriculum. Okay, that's what the educational model of discipleship is, by the way. You and I discipling another person, not to be necessarily like us, but we as people who are seeking to be conformed more and more to the image of Christ, as we disciple another person, they don't become more and more like us. Ideally, they become more and more like Christ. Do you get the idea there? So we become the curriculum. From a Christian worldview, if you're going to talk about discipleship, then if I'm teaching Sunday school, yes, it matters what the printed curriculum says, but ultimately it's the pattern of the life of the person. When the child is looking at the teacher, are they patterning the way that they're thinking and the way that they're speaking and the way that they're living after the teacher? That's discipleship. Okay? Dewey said, no. We want some professional social engineers. I don't care what the teacher's life is like. That doesn't matter. What the teacher thinks, what the teacher believes, how the teacher lives, this does not matter. What matters is that person function as a professional social engineer, because that's ultimately what we're trying to create, is a democracy. You're going to love this part. Here's what Dewey had in mind. He's a humanist philosopher, and here's what he had in mind. Pragmatic, progressive democracy. Democracy was the ethical ideal. He asserted that complete democracy included the cultivation of a fully formed public opinion. But guess how that fully formed public opinion was formed? Through the communication by experts, who, by the way, were teachers. Now, they weren't teachers like you and I may have thought of teachers. Instead, Dewey understood education as a function of psychology, and therefore teachers became professional social engineers. You think I'm being too harsh? You can go to Wikipedia and you can read all about it. Just look up John Dewey. Okay, a few years ahead of John Dewey over here on our side of the pond, over on the other side of the Atlantic was a guy named Abraham Kuyper, and he was reforming education in the Netherlands. He served as the prime minister from 1901 to 1905. So this gives you a little context here. His educational reforms really in the late 1800s in the Netherlands, and Dewey's educational reforms over here in America were in the early part of the 20th century. Okay, so in 1880, I know you're thinking to yourself, this is a history lesson. It is a history lesson, but history is really important because it takes about 100 years to reform an entire nation's educational process in the way that it thinks. So I need you to take a 100-year view today, because we're going to talk about educational reform. We're going to talk about what I think Betsy DeVos has in front of her and what's ahead of us. I think we're talking about needing to take a 100-year view of things. So we got to look back 100 years. 1880, Abraham Kuyper delivered the inaugural address of the Free University. Free, F-R-E-E. Free. Not free because it didn't cost anybody anything, but free because it was designed to, as with liberty as the point of its lance, was the way that he put it. So in his speech, in his inaugural address, Kuyper delivered this now famous quotation, which you cannot understand Betsy DeVos if you don't understand what Kuyper means when he says this. There is not one square inch in the whole domain of human existence over which Christ, who is sovereign over all, does not cry, mine. That speech and the educational philosophy that grows out of it is called sphere sovereignty. You cannot understand the showdown going on right now, and that's going to go on, between Betsy DeVos and the Democratic opposition If you don't understand Abraham Kuyper and John Dewey, if you don't understand the difference between sphere sovereignty and pragmatic humanistic education. Mother Jones clearly does not understand the difference, by the way. Does not understand the concept of sphere sovereignty. And so let me tell you why I think that. They wrote a January 17, 2017 piece entitled Betsy DeVos Wants to Use America's Schools to Build, quote unquote, God's Kingdom. God's Kingdom is in scare quotes there. I don't think you should be scared of it, but I think Mother Jones thinks you should be. Okay, so it leads off with a description of Holland, Michigan. Now, Holland, Michigan happens to be the town in which Betsy DeVos grew up and is definitely a part of. This is where she was educated. This is where she made her friends. This is where she went to college. These are her people, okay? And so they interviewed one of her classmates to describe, to help them understand what her approach might be. And her friends are really very clear. She's not against public schools, but you have to keep in mind that she never attended a public school. Well, why not? Well, because in Holland, Michigan, the school is basically a private school. Okay? A church started the town. The town, as a church, started a school. And if you understand John Calvin and you understand how he understood that all of culture and all of society was supposed to work together to promote not only public welfare but human flourishing, then you would understand how this works in Reformed theology. Well, Abraham Kuyper is a guy who, when you talk about the individual Christian bringing their life to bear, not only in personal piety, that my faith is not just a personal pietistic exercise, but that literally God has now called me to bring the full force of my life to bear on the positive outcomes in the world, human flourishing, let's say, let's use that language. Then if the area in which I feel called to make a positive change is education, then I'm going to put the full force of my life into that. I think that's what's going on here. Because I can't imagine any other reason that a billionaire would get into all this mess. And if you understand Kuyper's heart, if you understand his motivation to do what he did, and you understand the influence that Abraham Kuyper has on Betsy DeVos, whether or not she acknowledges it, whether or not she acknowledges his influence or not, is almost irrelevant. In the background of the fabric of her life in Holland, Michigan, through her own educational system, through her own experience of church and life at home, Abraham Kuyper is the driving influence. Abraham Kuyper says in this inaugural address of the Free University in October of 1880, he says this. Now, after you know what happened to her today, tell me that you don't hear a little echo effect here in Kuyper's words. The nature of my task, Kuyper says, drives me to that treacherous terrain of public life, where nettles and thorns on all hedges burn and wound at every step. Indeed, we cannot conceal, nor would any of us disguise the fact that we are not urged to this task. Hey, she got a 50-50 vote in the Senate. She's not urged to this task. Okay? So the only way you put yourself out for something like this is because there's a calling a whole lot bigger than what's going on here on this plane of existence. Kuyper goes on. The urge of this risky, if not presumptuous, endeavor was the deep-grained sense of duty, which impressed upon us that what we were doing must be done for Christ's sake, for the Lord's name, because of a high and holy importance for our people and our land. Kuyper thought there was an intimate connection between education. Remember, he's talking here about the reformation of education. That there's an intimate connection between the reformation of education and how young people are educated in a country and the country itself. He was addressing an underlying crisis in the Netherlands at the time. And he basically says what we're doing is a protest against the present environment. I believe there is something better available, and that the consideration of it causes us to act. And he says, I might have preferred to remain in the background. I imagine at this point, Betsy DeVos might have preferred to remain in the background. Kuiper goes on to say, it would have been much more comfortable to see others take the lead. However, since this could not be, since we must act, we came to the forefront. Indeed, not indifferent to the fact that people were had an aversion to us, but ordering our line of conduct exclusively in accordance with the demands of the criteria of God's honor. Kuiper actually thought God's honor was on the line. Not his own honor, not whether or not this was something he wanted to do, not whether or not he wanted to be out there in the spotlight, but that God's honor was on the line. That if you know what is right, if you know what's righteous, and you see injustice, you see kids who aren't getting the kind of education that should be made available to them, you see them being educated to become just just people who are going to reflect the views of whatever is pumped into them by some kind of psychological trope that is fed to them by people who are social engineers, which is what Dewey wants teachers to be. Betsy DeVos sees through that, and she says, I don't want kids to simply be socially engineered to become something that the quote-unquote experts of the day think they should become so that they will vote in a particular way to continue keeping this wheel going forward that's going nowhere. I think that's what's going on. I think that's what's going on with Betsy DeVos and the Department of Education. So I think Mother Jones is right to be afraid, very afraid, put God's kingdom in scare quotes there, because this is a sovereignty issue. When Kuiper talks about sphere sovereignty, he talks about the different domains or the different spheres in our life. Okay, so you and I have, you know, a social sphere, and we have a domestic sphere, and we have an intellectual sphere, and maybe we have a faith sphere. And basically what Kuiper says is God's sovereign over all of it. You may try to divide all of that up, but ultimately it cannot be divided. Ultimately, it's all under God's sovereign reign. And so what was going on in the Netherlands 145 years ago now is exactly the same thing that's going on today. Let me read you one more paragraph from his speech. He says, look, there are two credos that stand in clear-cut opposition to each other. He whose life proceeds from the revelational sphere, so there we're talking about people who believe in God and understand that ultimately God's sovereign over everything, whether or not we allow him to be sovereign over this moment or not, that person who's operating from the revelational sphere confesses as a matter of course that all sovereignty rests in God and therefore can proceed only from him, that this sovereignty of God has been conferred upon man. Okay, that means that it's our responsibility, along with the state, he says, and every other sphere of life, to understand that our sovereignty over a particular sphere is derivative. It ultimately all belongs to God. On the other hand, he says, those who do not perceive the reality of such a special revelational sphere and therefore deny it, what he's talking about is humanists, people who don't believe in God, assist that there must be absolute separation between the problem of sovereignty and the problem of faith, and they consequently assert that any sovereignty other than that of the state is unthinkable. They therefore zealously promote the embodiment of the sovereignty idea in its purest sense in the supreme state. Accordingly, they cannot grant to others any generous freedom. It all belongs to the state. What Dewey talked about in terms of democracy, Kuiper would view as absolute bondage. Because you give all sovereignty in terms of education to the state. And then all that you produce are little socially engineered puppets. Kuiper wanted people who, in every sphere of their life, would be living out the full freedom and liberty given to them by God. That's what Betsy DeVos is talking about when she talks about advancing God's kingdom in this time and in this place. She's talking about using every fiber of your being, in every sphere that you have influence, to advance the kingdom in every way that you can. All right, so I think there's a major showdown ahead, and I think it is a whole lot bigger than a lot of folks see. Okay, hey, before we go to the break, let me alert you, give me a little update on Andrew Brunson. We've talked about Andrew Brunson before. He's a 48-year-old pastor. He has been a missionary in the country of Turkey for 23 years. Last October, he was arrested, and he has been in jail ever since. He's had very, very limited interaction or access to communication with his wife, and seemingly no hope of getting out of prison. Well, I want to alert you to the fact that our president, President Trump, is going to be talking on the phone at 4 p.m. today with President Erdogan in Turkey. I want, if you do nothing else today, on behalf of another Christian, I want you to pray ardently right now that in that conversation, Andrew Brunson's concerns would be lifted up, and that our president would appeal to the president of Turkey for the release of Andrew Brunson. You and I both know the power of the Holy Spirit, and we know that God is able to do far more than we ordinarily dare to ask or imagine. So I think that in concert with one another, we ought to be asking the Lord. In fact, let's just do so. Father, we appeal to you on behalf of our brother, Andrew Brunson. We appeal to you, Father, somehow invade the conversation between President Donald Trump and President Erdogan that's going to happen at 4 p.m. Eastern today. Invade that conversation somehow and have Andrew Brunson's name lifted up, his concern lifted up, and turn the hearts of those involved in whatever way you need to, in order that Andrew might be released from the captivity that he is currently in, and that he might be able to declare again your glory. Father, we recognize that you're able to use him even when he's in prison in Turkey, but we would ask on his behalf right now, and on behalf of his precious family, that you would work in this conversation today to effect his release. Friends, you can follow this story as it unfolds. If you're on Twitter, you can use hashtag Forgotten American in Turkey. That's hashtag Forgotten American in Turkey to sort of stay up to date on this story. There is a White House petition, but it's apparently got a glitch in it, and it's actually not counting signatures. So that's a bit of a problem. But Forgotten American in Turkey is the hashtag on Twitter that you'll want to follow. And Andrew Brunson is the person for whom we want to be ardently praying. He's got a daughter who lives here in the States, and she is putting off her wedding, certainly hoping that her daddy can walk her down the aisle. So let's be praying for the Brunson family and for the release of Andrew from prison. Hey, right after the break, I'm going to be joined by veteran broadcast journalist Hugh Hewitt. We're going to be talking about Donald Trump. Hugh interviewed Trump 15 times on his radio show in the run-up to the election. And Hugh's got out a new book entitled The Fourth Way. It spells out how Donald Trump and the unified GOP can transform this nation. So The Fourth Way is really what I would describe as an old way. It just hasn't been tried since the days of Abraham Lincoln. So if you've been wondering what in the world Donald Trump and the unified GOP leaders in the Congress and their allies in 33 state houses across the country, what they might actually do, what could they do with this opportunity to remake America? Well, you got to hear Hugh Hewitt talk about it himself. I think you've got to read the new book. It is entitled The Fourth Way, The Conservative Playbook for a Lasting GOP Majority. I would describe it as a, wow, it's an energizing view of what America might look like if a half a dozen things were to change. All right, folks, Hugh Hewitt will be with me right back here on The Reconnect. We'll be right back. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to The Reconnect with your host, Carmen LaBurge. Now, back to Carmen.
Hello, friends. I'm Carmen LaBurge, and this is The Reconnect, where we're putting God in his place, back where he belongs, right in the middle of every conversation. So we are talking today about what people are talking about, bringing the headlines of the day into focus of the Christian worldview, hopefully equipping you to engage in the conversations of the day as the very ambassadors of Jesus Christ. So we invite you to connect with us online at reconnectwithcarmen.com. Let me know what you're thinking about on Twitter. I'm at Carmen LaBurge. All right, friends, I told you that right after the break we'd have Hugh Hewitt with us. So Hugh is here. He is a Harvard educated and University of Michigan educated lawyer. He's a constitutional law professor. You probably know him maybe as the host of the Hugh Hewitt Show, if you are one of the millions of people who listen to him every week. But you may also know him from television as an analyst for NBC News and MSNBC. You may now know him as a person who writes at the Washington Post. He's also an accomplished author, and his latest book is The Fourth Way, the conservative playbook for a lasting GOP majority. You can find everything you need to know at hughhewitt.com. Hugh, welcome to The Reconnect.
Carmen, thank you for having me back. I'm impressed that you were up to date on the Washington Post gig that was only announced yesterday.
Well, you know, I know how to Google things.
Yeah, that's the latest edition is going to work for the paper to turn in a column every couple of weeks on my worldview, which is very similar to your worldview, so it should be fun.
Yeah, we're totally looking forward to it. So I want to talk to you about the news of the day. I want to do so sort of through a conversation about the book. The Fourth Way, I think it's just great. You lay out such a clear and compelling prescription for what the president and the Republican leaders need to do and do quickly, as you point out. Part of that prescription is the selection of the right justices and judges. So, jumping to the headlines with the nomination of Neil Gorsuch to the Supreme Court, let's just start there. Why do we need the right judges and justices, and is this guy the right one?
He's a terrific choice, Carmen. I was skeptical through the whole campaign, but I based my almost uniform support of Donald Trump. I got off the Trump train a couple of times when he attacked Judge Curiel. I was upset with him. After the Access video, I asked him to get out. He didn't get out, but I voted for him largely because of the United States Supreme Court and that vacancy sitting there that Justice Scalia's death created a year ago. And there have been a lot of 4-4 decisions since then, a lot of split cases. Some of them meant that rulings we liked stayed in place, like the injunction of President Obama's executive order on illegal immigration. In some cases, we lost that we would have liked to have won, like the Little Sisters of the Poor, which would have upheld that order's refusal to be complicit in abortion. And so we need 9 justices, but that 9th seat is so crucial. Now, when it comes to Judge Gorsuch, I don't know him. I followed his career from afar for a long time. He's 49, so he's 11 years younger than me. He's a bit behind me. He did not serve in the Reagan administration like I did, but I followed him for a long time because I taught out at Colorado Christian University for a year, and he's a 10th Circuit judge, and Colorado was his home, and everybody knows him and mentions him to me. But federal judges don't do politics, so our paths have not crossed. But he's a Federalist Society favorite. Leonard Leo thinks the world of him, as do most of the scholars of the Constitution that I know in the originalist camp. So it's a home run for our side, which I think especially means for religious liberty. When I'm done talking with you, I will go down and teach my First Amendment seminar on what the Free Exercise Clause means. I'm going to teach the Elaine photography case today, where a photographer was obliged by the New Mexico Human Rights Commission and the New Mexico Supreme Court to photograph a same-sex wedding, despite the fact that it deeply offended her Christian sensibilities. She was facing either financial ruin or compliance. I believe that's unconstitutional. I believe that the Supreme Court needs to take up a balancing test in these cases where people now do have the right to get married if they're of the same sex. At the Obergefell, I don't think that's going to be overturned. But at the same time, there are lots of people in this country who simply object on religious grounds to participating in such ceremonies in close proximity to them where their art especially is in use. And the court needs to come up with a test to decide when is that acceptable and when is that invidious discrimination of the sort we don't want to put up with. And I'm glad Judge Gorsuch will be Justice Gorsuch when they decide that issue.
Oh, I agree with you. So when we get to the Johnson Amendment, when that actually becomes a live conversation out there, we'll have to have another conversation about free exercise and the First Amendment and whether or not the Johnson Amendment should stand or not. But we'll save that one for another day. Let's talk about the themes of the Fourth Way. You talk about the way forward for America under unified leadership, including obviously the president, but also Republican leaders in the House and Senate. And you talk about, their cooperation with 33 state houses across the country. I love your emphasis on the local in the book. So you talk about trusting local people, not seeking to trust or enrich federal or state bureaucracies. You talk about transparency and accountability. And then you emphasize, above all, speed. So, Counselor Hewitt, has Donald Trump started fast enough for you, and has he started fast on the right things?
He started fast enough in some things. I would have gone faster on Judge Gorsuch. I would have actually announced his nomination during the transition so that the paperwork would have been done and they'd be moving through the hearings. It took too long for Betsy DeVos, for example. It's taking too long for Andy Puzner. There's a rule in Washington, which is they always go too slow, Carmen. It's you and I have to show up every day and hit our marks and be on the air and do our show. And if we don't, we're off the air. Congress has no such discipline. The president can take his own time. And Mitch McConnell, in his wonderful book, The Long Game, said you can start too late, but you can never start too early. And I do believe in go big, go far, go fast. That's my hashtag, go big, go far, go fast. President Trump campaigned on a number of things. Infrastructure, I think he ought to get it. A wall, I think he ought to get it. He campaigned on a 350-ship Navy. I think he ought to get that. He campaigned on regulatory rollback. I think they're helping him with the Congressional Review Act, throw about rules that date back 60 legislative days, which is back to June of 2016. But he didn't campaign on entitlement reform. Paul Ryan wants that. He wants to reform Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, and Obamacare. They both agree on repeal of Obamacare. So there's a big deal to be had, and I think you can even sugarcoat it for Democrats a little bit with immigration regularization. I think pretty much anyone who's in the country without documents, who's kept their nose clean, has worked hard, and is a good person, not accepting benefits, ought to be allowed to stay. Not vote. I'm not a citizenship fairy godmother. But I don't think we ought to spend a lot of time rounding people up and sending them home if they're good, hardworking immigrants. And the big deal here is draw Democrats in with that, give the president what he campaigned on, give Paul Ryan what he campaigned on, and he did campaign on that, and everybody wins.
So one of the things that fascinated me in the book, and I actually woke my husband up on the airplane on our way back from Colorado, I said, "Did you know this?" And so I read this to him because I'm going to guess that there's a lot of people listening that don't know this. And this is in your what I will describe as the fearless chapter on impeachment. You were unafraid to address the prospect of presidential impeachment. So let me just read this one couple sentences to my listeners. If necessary in the eyes of a majority of the House members, the members can impeach a president in a day. If necessary in the eyes of two-thirds of the senators present, a president can be removed from office the same day as the impeachment articles are voted. There's no magic here, no necessary timeline. I have to tell you, that was a surprise to me.
That's because you're too young for Nixon, but you probably read about it in the history books. You may be old enough to barely remember Clinton, and none of us know Andrew Johnson. But the precedents of the Senate and the House on impeachment are few. The words in the Constitution are fewer. And the words in the Federalist paper, to the extent that they apply, are even older and less consulted. But impeachment is merely a power. It's like a shotgun in the closet. You don't use it unless you have to. And when you do use it, you can use it at any time and any place you want to. And you may do enormous damage to innocent people, but it's always in there. And impeachment has no rules attached to it. It's entirely up to the House and the Senate to run it when they want to and to run it if they want to. It's a political process. And we think of it as reserved for high crimes and misdemeanors because that's the language. But the language isn't defined, and the courts would never interfere with the Congress and with the House and the Senate in their exercise of it. Now, I don't think it's going to happen to Donald Trump unless the House goes Democratic, some awful crime or misdemeanor occurs of the sort that I don't think is going to happen. But they're already setting him up. for articles of impeachment, Carmen, with the emoluments clause nonsense, with the muttering about his obsessions, with the intimation that he's not balanced. I listen to every single newscast out there, and they are laying the predicate, as we say in the law, for inferring that he's not stable and not fit to be president. It's all baloney, but it's a constant repetition works in America. If I say the fourth way seven times, according to Frank Luntz, people remember the fourth way and they'll buy the fourth way. And so if you say obsession, 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 listen for that word. It's a word Democrats have agreed off the record among themselves to use about Donald Trump to plant the seed of doubt nationally about his stability. That's what's going on. It's very obvious to me that discrediting, the delegitimization of the president as a setup for, if they get the House back, impeachment.
Hey, folks, the voice you're hearing is probably very familiar to you if you listen to Salem Media nationally. He is Hugh Hewitt of The Hugh Hewitt Show. I'd invite you to find everything that he's writing about and talking about at hughhewitt.com. We're talking today about his latest book, The Fourth Way, The Conservative Playbook for a Lasting GOP Majority. All right, Hugh, one more question before you go. And by the way, my first political memory is actually sitting at the top of the stairs and Richard Nixon was resigning. I mean, he was on TV and I was sent upstairs because apparently, you know, well, I viewed it as traumatic. And so I sat at the top of the stairs and I listened and I watched. And my first political memory is I thought America was coming to an end because if the president quit, like in my view, if the president quit from a little child's perspective, that's so I was around and I thought it was not only dramatic, but traumatic. So
that's funny.
Big deal.
One of my earliest political memories is waking up and hearing my parents in the kitchen talking about Bobby Kennedy being shot. And I'm a Catholic kid. And you could hear the TV on in the kitchen, and he'd been shot the night before at the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles, long after we'd all gone to bed. So it was all news, and they were very upset, and I was very upset. You know, kids don't quite get politics. They don't understand the enduring nature of the Union. It can survive a civil war. But I got a quick question for you. Can I turn it around on you?
Sure, absolutely.
Did you ever read The Shack?
I did read The Shack.
I saw the movie yesterday. I never read The Shack, because I don't read books like that, because I'm not a touchy-feely guy. I'm a political analyst. But the impact on the audience was amazing, but some people think it's heretical. What do you think? It's a great movie, by the way. What do you think?
Well, I haven't seen the movie, so I'll have to base my comments on the book. There are certainly some challenging interpretations of the Trinity. And so if you're a person who, you know, wants to stick to a close biblical understanding of who God represents himself to be, there are some representations in The Shack that are not aligned with Scripture. If you understand that it is one person's, I think, way of processing through an emotional experience and introducing people to an understanding of God as a relational being, it's not a bad thing.
Yeah, I was pleasantly surprised to find out it was Trinitarian. I mean, it's kind of goofball Trinitarian, but it's Trinitarian. It had an emotional impact on many people in the audience I had invested in, especially those with a lot of sorrow and grief in their life. And so I'm curious if you're going to go see a screening, and I'll be curious to hear what you think about it. Maybe you'll come on my show and talk about it when it comes out, because it's going to be quite the controversy in Christian circles.
Well, I absolutely agree to come on and talk about it, and we're actually developing an equipping resource for people to engage in conversation about it. So thanks for that opportunity.
Oh, terrific.
Hey, we always look forward to talking with you and listening to you and reading you. Folks, you can find everything that Hugh's talking about at hughhewitt.com. You can also now read him in the Washington Post every couple of weeks. You can hear him every day on Salem Media. Hugh, thanks again for joining us on The Reconnect.
Carmen, always a joy. God bless. Be well.
Thank you. All right, friends, it's time to go below the fold. We talk about this as the time in the show where we try to lift up stories, make connections that are designed to help you start and engage with others in conversations that may not initially appear to be about God. So see, if I had known in advance that Hugh wanted to talk about The Shack, I'd be prepared to talk about The Shack below the fold today, but I didn't know that. So today, instead, I'm going to talk about a Cheeto that is shaped like Harambe the gorilla. I know, because that's all. It's not quite as crazy. All right, so here's the deal. I know, you're thinking to yourself, did she just say that? A Cheeto shaped like Harambe the gorilla. Now, let's start with the fact that you and I, already as a cultural reference, when I say Harambe the gorilla, you and I already have a shared reference point. That in and of itself is a little bit frightening. So Animal rights activists would say that one of their goals is to be sure that you and I start giving names to animals in order that the animal has a level of personification to us. It's anthropomorphized. It's made more human by giving it a name. And so instead of referring to an animal as an it, as soon as we start referring to it, even with personal pronouns, he and she, but when we begin referring to it beyond personal pronouns with a personal name like Harambe, then Harambe must be referred to no longer as an it, but as an individual. Okay, so Harambe, the gorilla, you will remember, is the gorilla who lived in the zoo in Cincinnati where a small boy, 4 years old, fell into the gorilla enclosure. Now, this story was probably going to end tragically one way or the other. The question is, do you make a moral equivalence between the gorilla and the child, or do you esteem the value of a human life as greater than the value of a gorilla life? Now, we're going to come back to that in just a minute because we're talking about the relative value of a Cheeto. Yes, you heard me right, a Cheeto. Okay, so here's the story. This is posted on the Daily Dot. But if you Google Harambe right now, this is the story that's going to come up because this was an auction for a hot Cheeto that looks like Harambe. David Cavucci posted this story, and he informs us that the hot Cheeto, which is shaped to, it's not intentionally shaped to look like Harambe the gorilla. This guy literally pulls a Cheeto out of the bag, thinks to himself, that kind of looks like Harambe the gorilla. And he posts it on eBay for a very reasonable, very, very reasonable, you know, funny amount, right? Couple of bucks. I don't know. The original bid was $11.99. Maybe that's what he originally posted it for. Starting price of $11.99. Now you think to yourself, well, that's kind of funny. You know, somebody might be willing to pay that just for a joke on eBay. Well, the thing turned into something other than a joke. The Cheeto, the hot Cheeto, shaped like Harambe the gorilla, went for, and I'm reading this off of the eBay site itself, the auction ended on February the 7th at 8:20 a.m., and the winning bid, 132 bids later, was $99,900. $99,900. 100 bucks short of 100 grand. Is the relative value in our culture of a hot Cheeto shaped like Harambe the gorilla? All right, so back to why do you and I both know the name of a gorilla named Harambe? Because I frankly am not going to be able to unpack for you why anyone would be willing to pay $99,900 for a hot Cheeto shaped like anything. But from a Christian worldview, the conversation about the relative value of human life versus any other form of life is a conversation that we have to be equipped to have. People are precious because they're made in the image of God. People have value, intrinsic worth, because we are not only made in the image of God, we are bought back at the price of the blood of Christ. And so when we talk about creatures and we talk about the relative value of a creature versus the relative value of a human being, yes, we are a creature, but humans are made in the image of God and the animal kingdom is not. And so when the little boy slips into the gorilla enclosure and the gorilla sees this small play toy, he assumes, it's a 400-pound gorilla and a 40-pound child. And he sees this play toy show up in his in the little pool section of his enclosure, and he goes and he grabs it. Now, he's a gorilla. He doesn't check to see if he's grabbing it by the hand or the arm. He happens to grab it by the foot, and he drags it out of the water. Now, contributing to the mayhem is the crowd screaming above, which, of course, the gorilla wants to get away from and so drags the child into an area that obscures the view. So it's very difficult to see then what's happening and to judge whether or not the gorilla has any kind of intent to harm the child, which is impossible to assess anyway. And they could have shot the gorilla with a tranquilizer gun, but if they had done that, it would have agitated the gorilla, and it takes some time for the tranq to have any effect. And so it was the decision of the dangerous animal response team, known as DART, to take the one shot that would be a kill shot. And Harambe died. And the world was sent into an uproar. And the question was asked, why the gorilla and not the boy? Now, once we reach the stage in our culture where we are asking the question about whether or not we are going to save the child or save the gorilla, we have reached a point in our ethical conversation, in our moral discussions as a people, where you can clearly say we are not all operating out of the same worldview. And you say back to me, well, Carmen, we could have told you that. I mean, abortion is evidence of the fact that America does not value human life in the same way, or value every human life in the same way. And we talk about pro-life issues here a lot on the Reconnect. But this is a pro-life conversation as well. Is the animal or the child more valuable? That's a good question. The Bible says that where your money is, there your heart will be also. So this person who was willing to pay $99,900 for a hot Cheeto that's shaped like Harambe the gorilla, I got a question about where their heart is. That $99,900 could be spent in a lot of ways to do a lot of good in a lot of places for a lot of people, or even for a gorilla. Because you and I do have some responsibility as stewards of creation to take care of the animals and their habitats. And so we are stewards over all of God's creation, managers of it, and we ought to be working for its good as well. All right, friends, we are in the month of February, and in the month of February, you probably think of that as the month of love. And by the way, gentlemen, you've got like a week. Isn't today the 7th? Okay, a week from today is going to be the 14th. The 14th of February is my sister's birthday. But more relevant to everyone else, it is Valentine's Day. And so Valentine's Day is a great day to celebrate the gift of love. Now, I would say it's also a great day to celebrate the fruits of the Spirit, the first of which is love. And then you got joy, and you got peace, and you got patience. And in this list is kindness, which gets me to the concept of kindness month. We're doing the 30-day kindness challenge. We invite you to join us in the 30-day kindness challenge. You can do so by going to reconnectwithcarmen.com. And right on there, we got a big banner ad thing for the kindness challenge. And you can click on there, and you can join us in the kindness challenge. Now, here's the deal. In the kindness challenge, you consider someone in your life, maybe who you tend to be critical of. This is the way I've approached it. Okay. So you choose a person who maybe you tend to be critical of, and you say to yourself, all right, I am going to impress upon myself. I am going to actively engage in a discipline of not being critical. And in fact, finding something positive to point out, and then finding a way every day to do some small act of kindness or service for them. So join us in the kindness challenge. Pray right now with me as our president gets on the phone with President Erdogan. I am lifting up Andrew Brunson and asking the Holy Spirit to invade that conversation and change his reality. All right, friends, this is The Reconnect. I'm Carmen LaBurge. Connect with us online at reconnectwithcarmen.com. We'll see you right back here tomorrow. Have a great day, and God bless.
The Reconnect is brought to you by the Presbyterian Lay Committee. To continue the conversation and become part of the Reconnect community, visit reconnectwithcarmen.com.